Hey, it's David Pogue. I'm the guest on 20 Minutes for Tech, episode number 34, talking about consumer tech and what it means for education.
Welcome to another edition of 20 Minutes for Tech, your instructional technology podcast. I'm your host, Dave Solon. Yes, that was David Pogue introducing this episode, and I'm excited to share our conversation on the podcast. Please note that links and show notes can always be found at 20fortech.com. That's 20fortech.com. David was here today for the first Tech Talk Live technology conference held where I work at the Lancaster Lebanon IU13. He started off the day with a keynote and then also held several breakout sessions. If you aren't familiar with David's work, just drop by the personal technology section of the New York Times online and you'll find his columns, his Pogue's Posts blog, as well as a link to his entertaining and informational videos. I especially like the one on underwater photography. David has also written a multitude of books in the Missing Manual series, as well as the Dummies series. If you like a good chuckle, I'd also suggest his The World According to Twitter book. It's chock full of the wit and wisdom from the Twitter sphere. So, without further ado, here's my chat with the one and only David Pogue.
So I'm really glad to welcome David Pogue to 20 for Tech, our instructional technology podcast. I don't see how you couldn't know who Mr. Pogue is when it comes to things, but he's a tech and fellow gadget guy, written many missing manuals, and most prominently writes for the New York Times columns as well as Pogue's Posts on your blog. So thanks for taking out your time from your busy schedule here today and being with us.
Happy to be here.
Really, really appreciate it. You talked a little bit about disruptive technology, and that's been a theme for quite a while, actually, in education. What's your take on disruptive technologies and maybe how they're... I know you're not necessarily an education guy, although you are in a way, because you help us all learn about all these cool things that are out there. What do you think about disruptive technology and all that?
Well, yeah, you're right. My job is to know the technology, the consumer technology, and it's the jobs of the readers and the listeners to apply that to their own field. So I've never worked in education. I'm not exactly sure what would be disruptive tech for education. But I think, you know, obviously the definition of a disruptive tech is something that comes along and completely changes the old way of doing things. You know, the iTunes store completely changed the way we buy music, and, you know, DVDs completely changed the way we consume movies and so on. Today I was at this conference talking about a few of them, but the thrust for the next generation, for the people we're teaching right now, is largely instant gratification. If you think of every digital technology, I mean, it started with music. You know, people don't want to go buy the CD. Now they download the song instantly, even straight to their phones. Television now, you know, go to Hulu or go to iTunes and buy the show you want. I mean, who sits down at 8 o'clock on CBS to watch a certain show? You watch it when you want. Movies now on demand. And I was talking today about an experience I had last year. I conducted a national campaign on Twitter and in my blog and in my Times column, railing against a certain habit that the cell phone companies have. When we leave a message for someone on their voicemail, we hear their greeting, like, "Hi, it's David, leave a message," and then we hear a canned 15-second recording imposed on us by the cell phone company that gives us instructions on how to leave a message. And it says, you know, you may begin speaking at the tone, press 5 to page this person. AT&T even said press 4 to send a fax. How do you send a fax from your cell phone? And then it says, when you have finished recording, you may hang up, which is kind of like, oh, really? No kidding. And it's all just a giant revenue generator. It's just to eat up our airtime. That's
right.
The only
reason. Keep you on the phone, right?
Right. And I did a little math, and for Verizon alone, their 90 million customers, if we endure that 15-second message twice a day, which would be like leaving one message and checking your own messages, you hear a similar message when you call in, that comes to $750 million a year of our money. That's 3.5 hours per person that you spend listening to that message over and over and over and over. And that's just one carrier. You know, there's four or five big carriers in this country. So it's billions of dollars that we're wasting. Anyways, so I started this campaign to put public pressure on these companies to get rid of that voicemail greeting. And it had some success. AT&T cut theirs in half, and a couple others said, okay, we will at the next software rev. But at the time, I was working with a 19-year-old college student who was my intern for the summer, and he was helping me with it, but he'd look at me and go, okay, but I don't get it. And I'm like, what do you mean you don't get it? And he said, who leaves voicemail anymore? And I'm like, everybody? And he goes, nobody I know leaves voicemail. And I said, what are you talking about? How do you know that I called and when I called? And he said, it's called the call log. It's on your cell phone. It says what the missed calls were, who it was, and when it was. I don't need you to say, hi, it's David. I called at 5 o'clock. It's right there. Right? And he was baffled by that. And so voicemail is going away. Email is going away. Television broadcasting is going away. Landlines are going away. Newspapers are going away. Magazines are going away. It has to be random access, and it has to be on demand. And that's what the next generation expects.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you mentioned Twitter, and I know many folks in the educational world, especially in K-12, there's a small section that uses Twitter and utilizes it for sharing and that kind of stuff. And I found it really interesting. I was watching one of your videos, which are excellent, by the way.
Thank you.
You can check those out on the New York Times site. And it was about how you, well, tell us about how you use Twitter to crowdsource your iPad video.
Well, so I'll answer that question in a second. But first, in terms of education, I want to tell a story about how I got into Twitter. I sort of ignored it for a long time because there are so many of these social media things. And the first time it really hit me between the eyes, I was asked to judge a grant proposal run by the MacArthur people, and so we had all this money to give away, and it was technology grants for good ideas, and somebody said, oh, I want to create a van that would be a complete self-contained optometrist office, eyeglass making outfit that could travel sub-Saharan Africa where they have no medical care at all, no eye care, no glasses, no nothing, and make glasses for people on the spot.
Wow.
So the 12 of us on the judging panel sat around like, hasn't that been done? Didn't someone do that? We looked at each other blankly. You know, we had 100 proposals to get through. We didn't have a lot of time. And so we're just looking at each other, and this guy sitting next to me opens his laptop, goes on Twitter, and types, has this been done? And in 10 seconds, there were people, oh yeah, you know, UNICEF, 1997, Bausch and Lomb, 2002. I mean, all this incredible information with links. And
in seconds.
And I mean, there's no other channel in the world that could have performed that. You know, sending out an email blast, putting up a website, making a phone call. None of it would have had the same combination of crowdsourcing and real-time interaction as Twitter. And so I started, and so I mentioned that because this guy was in education. This guy was an academic. And his followers were in his field.
Right.
And so that is one key amazing thing. And he didn't have a ton of them, but there were people who travel in his circles and who were interested in his topic. And so that really opened my eyes to what Twitter could be. It's not, as common misconception has it, you know, what did I eat for lunch today? It's really unbelievable.
And so there is some of that.
Yeah, but you don't follow those people.
right.
So I sort of copied him, and I've just been doing crowdsourcing experiment after crowdsourcing experiment. I will need an opening joke for a column. I'll ask people for ideas for that. I did this whole book where I would ask a provocative question every night, like, you know, describe your first kiss or describe current events in the style of Dr. Seuss or make up a funny movie prequel title. And people would write back with these really funny answers, and then I published the best ones in this book called The World According to Twitter. And as you say, I frequently harness my followers for for use on my weekly videos.
Sure.
From needing people to show up at my house and be actors in them, to ideas, and then last week's was a video about the iPad.
Right.
And I had this idea that it would be, because there's so much frenzy and hype about the iPad, I thought it should be a parody of that. And so the scene is I'm sitting in front of a big flat panel monitor filled like the Brady Bunch opening with a tic-tac-toe grid of all these people out there in America land with questions about the iPad, only it wouldn't be 9, it would be, you know, 30 or 25 people all in little squares in front of me, all reacting like a crowd, like they're all in front of their webcams, but they're all reacting to what I'm saying or asking questions or groaning or clapping or whatever. And I had next to no time to put this together. And so I went on Twitter and said, hey, I need 25 extras for my video. If you're interested, email me right now. And, you know, 150 people emailed. They all wanted to be in the video. And
how long did that take to get that feedback?
Oh, about 20 minutes.
Yeah, that's incredible.
And then I wrote a little macro that answered each one and said, okay, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to send you a list of reactions that I need you to film on your webcam, and I need you to send me these video clips by tomorrow lunchtime. And by the way, I need you to send me back a picture of you because I can only use 25 of you, and I want to pick a representative sample. So All these people wrote back with pictures and said, okay, count me in. I understand. I have a webcam. And I picked 25, and they were fantastic. I mean, they were absolutely hilarious, and each one of them should have gotten their own, you know, close-up, but they were, so, and, you know, sometimes I feel guilty. I'm like, man, I'm like, taking all the work out of my job. I'm getting other people to write my book and write my jokes and be in my videos and answer my questions. A lot of times I'll go on with tech questions, or does anyone know how cell phone monopolies work in Europe? You know, just research stuff. And the thing is, though, nobody minds. I mean, they don't. Mm-hmm. They don't only not mind. They like helping out. They like being involved. They like participating. That's why they're on Twitter.
Right.
So I'm sort of feeling guilty for nothing. But it's true that this whole crowdsourcing thing is like just completely hit me where I live.
That's neat. That great uses for Twitter. Obviously, sharing ideas, sharing information, and like you said, gathering resources in a quick, easy way.
That's right.
So. Talking about the iPad, do you think it will change education in any ways? Or maybe not the iPad itself, but, how do cell phones and how does this instant-on information society change education, do you think?
Well, I would think that the iPad and all the imitators that will be coming out later this year would have a couple implications for education. One is, you know, for a lot of the things that systems are buying laptops for, You could buy these. They have no moving parts. They'll last longer. Much simpler to use. There's nothing to troubleshoot. There's no viruses. There's no maintenance. They're a lot cheaper than laptops. Mm-hmm. So I would think that that school boards would want to look into buying batches of these things instead of laptops. Mm-hmm. You can still do your web research and your email and then, of course, there are thousands and thousands of educational apps that are, you know, from music training and language flashcards and
StarWatch.
Yeah, exactly. StarWalk, this amazing astronomy app where you hold the iPad over your head, looking up at the sky, and the thing uses its tilt sensors and GPS sensors and orientation sensors to display the image of the stars that you're seeing in the correct orientation that matches what's actually in the sky, but with labels for all the stars. So yeah, there's a million educational apps. Again, much, much cheaper. We're talking $5 programs instead of $80 programs. Much cheaper than you'd get with a Windows or a Mac program.
One encouraging thing, especially with some of our districts now, they're finally opening up their networks and having that, I don't want to say free, but free Wi-Fi for kids and students to bring in their own devices now. So not only will the school maybe not have to purchase those devices, and now they'll let them on their network since they're getting more comfortable with that whole idea.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to see a lot more of this.
The other thing about the iPad is many people have observed that it's the perfect old person's computer because you don't waste any time learning an operating system. I mean, it's like an elevator. Everyone knows how to punch an elevator button. That's the whole interface is buttons, those little apps. But the same could be true for very young kids. I mean,
sure.
They can get right into doing the work or the play without having to learn the computer and that the awkwardness of learning the mouse and all that stuff.
Right, and that tactile interface, kids are used to using their hands and doing that kind of stuff. It's amazing when you see the YouTube videos with just, you know, two-year-olds working their, you know, their parents' iPhones.
It's really amazing.
And going to, you know, whatever app that they have there. Now, no session like this would be right without a tech tip from David Pogue. Tell us about readability.
Oh yeah, this is my favorite find. So this is a reaction against the fact that as the web has grown up, it has become junkier and more cluttered and more difficult to read. So even on, let's say, a New York Times article, you will have three levels of titles and headings above. You'll have blinking, moving, flash animated ads on both sides of the column you're trying to read. You'll have, you know, links and ads and most emailed lists and just all this garbage that's not the article that you're trying to read.
Right.
And, you know, multiply this times every website you see. People think they're cool for making things blink and flash and have obnoxious color screens, you know, yellow type on a black background and so on. And the type is too tiny a lot of times. So readability is this free, it's called a bookmarklet. Basically, you go to the creator's website, just Google it, you'll find it, and you drag this button onto your toolbar, and there it stays. From now on, whenever you're on a web page and you click that button on your toolbar, the entire page is redesigned instantly to look like a Kindle screen or something. It's black type on a white background in a nice font that you've selected, with nothing blinking, no lists, no colors, nothing but the text of the article itself.
What you want to get to.
Yeah, exactly. Everything else drops away. All the ads, all the blinkings, all the tables of contents and, you know, headlines and so on. And it changes lives. I mean, I wrote about this in the Times, and people, you know, thanked me like I was the inventor of it. It was like, oh my gosh, this changed my life. And it's, you know, people say, so aren't you depriving the advertisers of their advertising, which pays for your free web? And I'm like, yeah, but they're the ones who ruined it by making their ads blink at me. Mm-hmm. So they kind of brought it on themselves.
Design a better way to advertise, right?
Right, that's
put
right.
Put the onus on them.
Don't be so obnoxious and I won't have to shut you off.
Exactly. Okay, I'll hit you with one more here. Now, obviously you're the guy, the go-to guy for when it comes to new stuff. Who do you go to? Who do you read? How do you keep up with this stuff? Any specific hints that you can give us without giving away the form?
You know, it's funny about that because I used to make house calls and teach people their computers, and some of them were celebrities, and there's this one guy who's a famous singer, and you know, he sold 70 million albums or something like that, and I got to know him, and one day he was saying, oh man, I hate my life, and I'm like, what are you talking about? And he goes, I'm just never gonna get anywhere. Like, dude, what are you talking about? You've sold 70 million albums. He goes, 70 million is nothing. Madonna's sold 300 million. The Beatles have sold 780 million, you know, or whatever. Wherever you are, there's somebody better than you, no matter what your field, no matter who you are. So that's kind of how I feel. So no, I'm not the go-to guy. I'm a repackager. I'm a curator. I'm a
coordinator.
Explainer. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So most of my stuff comes into my inbox as pitches from the electronics and software companies themselves who want coverage. So
Right. It's
kind of a self-sustaining thing. They feed me stuff, and I just pick the most interesting ones and review them. So. But I also, you know, I read Gizmodo.com and Gadget.com, and I subscribe to a ton of magazines, home theater magazines, photography magazines, science magazines, and of course I read everybody else's tech columns online. So I just read a lot. I go to conferences. Usually I'm there to speak, but I also, you know, absorb stuff through ad hoc conversations. So it's just, you know, all the on Twitter. A lot of tips coming from Twitter. David, are you going to review the blah, blah, blah? And I'm like, the heck is that? And turns out it's something worth looking at.
And it works. My undergrad was actually in biomedical photography. And I also, as you can see from the pictures, I scuba dive a little bit. And your review of the two cameras, the underwater cameras, I think I might buy the T2 just because of you. So
yeah.
So advertisers out there, if you're listening, David's doing a good job. Obviously, we all know that. But thanks so much. I can't thank you enough for sitting down with me and just talking today and kind of talking about some of these issues.
My pleasure.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Well, that wraps up another edition of 20 Minutes for Tech, your instructional technology podcast. We say a huge thanks to Mr. David Pogue. Definitely check his work out at the New York Times. And we'll just remind you that show notes are always available at 20fortech.com. That's 20fortech.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you back here next time.